Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Shiloh, a novel, by Shelby Foote, narrated by Peter Burkrot. 1. Lieutenant Palmer Metcalf, aide-de-camp, Johnston's staff. The sky had cleared, the clouds raveled to tatters, and at 4 o'clock the sun broke through. Silver on the bright green of grass and leaves and golden on the puddles in the road. All down the column men quickened the step, smiling in the sudden burst of golden-silver weather. They would point at the sky, the shining fields, and call to each other, "The sun! The sun!" Their uniforms, which had darkened in the rain, began to steam in the April heat, and where formerly they had slogged through the mud, keeping their eyes down on the boots or haversack of the man ahead. Now they began to look around, and even dance aside with little prancing steps to avoid the wet places. As we rode past at the side of the road, they cheered and called out to us, "You better keep up there! Don't get left behind!" Replacing their hats from cheering the general, they jeered at me especially, since I was the youngest and brought up the rear. "Jog on, sonny! If you lose him, you'll never find him again." This was mainly a brown country, cluttered with dead leaves from the year before. But the oaks had tasseled and the redbud limbs were like flames in the wind. Fruit trees and cabin yards, peach and pear and occasional quince, were sheathed with bloom, white and pink, twinkling against broken fields and random cuts of new grass washed clean by the rain. Winding over and among the red clay hills, the column had strung out front and rear, accordion action causing it to clot in places and move spasmodically in others, as if the road itself had come alive, had been sowed with the dragon teeth of olden time, and was crawling like an enormous snake toward Pittsburgh Landing. Seen that way, topping a rise and looking back and forward, it was impersonal, an army in motion. So many inspissated tons of flesh and bone and blood and equipment. But seen from close, the mass reduced to company size in a short dip between two hills. It was not that way at all. I could see their faces then, and the army became what it really was. 40,000 men. They were young men mostly, lots of them even younger than myself, and I was 19 just 2 weeks before. Out on their first march in the crazy weather of early April, going from Mississippi into Tennessee, where the Union Army was camped between two creeks with its back to a river, inviting destruction. This was the third day out, and their faces showed it. Rain and mud, particularly where artillery and wagon trains had churned the road, had made the march a hard one. Their faces were gay now in the sunlight, but when you looked close, you saw the sullen lines of strain about the mouths and the lower eyelids etched with fatigue. We had doubled back down the column all morning, then retraced, and as we approached the crossroads a few hundred yards west of last night's headquarters, we saw General Beauregard standing in one of the angles of a rail fence, talking with two of the corps commanders, Generals Bragg and Polk. Beauregard was wagging his head, his big, sad bloodhound eyes rimmed with angry red and his hands fluttering. He was obviously upset, which was understandable, for it was 10 hours past the time when we should have been pressing them back against the river. When we rode up, they turned and waited for General Johnston to speak, and when he had greeted them with that careful courtesy he always used, Beauregard began to repeat what he had been saying to the others. He favored canceling the movement, returning to Corinth. Just hearing him say it, I suddenly felt tired all over. "There is no chance for surprise," he said, shaking his head and shrugging his shoulders with that French way he had. "They'll be entrenched to the eyes." General Johnston looked at him for a moment without saying anything, then turned to Bishop Polk, they had roomed together at West Point, and asked what he thought. Men in the passing column turned their heads, watching, but they did not cheer because they could see this was a conference. The bishop said his troops were eager for battle. They had left Corinth on the way to a fight, he said, and if they didn't find one, they would be as demoralized as if they had been whipped. He said it in that deep pulpit voice of his. It was as if I could hear his vestments rustle. It sounded fine. General Bragg said he felt the same way about it. He would as soon be defeated as return without fighting. General Breckinridge, commander of the reserve, rode up while Bragg was speaking. He lifted his eyebrows, surprised that withdrawal was even being considered. He sided with Bragg and Bishop Polk. General Hardee was the only corps commander not present, but there was no doubt which side he would favor. Hardee was always spoiling for a fight. When General Johnston had heard them out, he drew himself up in the saddle, leather creaking, and said quietly, "Gentlemen, we shall attack at daylight tomorrow." It was as if a weight had been lifted from my shoulders and I could breathe. He told them to form their corps according to the order and to have the troops sleep on their arms in line of battle. As he pulled his horse aside, passing me, he spoke to Colonel Preston. "I would fight them if they were a million," he said. "They can present no greater front between those two creeks than we can, and the more men they crowd in there, the worse we can make it for them." I never knew anyone who did not think immediately that General Johnston was the finest-looking man he had ever seen, and everyone who ever knew him loved him. He was a big man, well over 6 feet and close to 200 pounds in weight, neither fat nor lean. He gave at once an impression of strength and gentleness. His expression was calm as we rode away, but his eyes were shining. That was as it should be, for this was his hour of vindication after 2 months of retreat and ugly talk which had followed adulation. When he crossed the desert from California in 61, dodging Apaches and federal squadrons from cavalry posts along the way, and started north for Richmond from New Orleans, he was hailed as the savior of liberty. And when he reported to General Davis in September, he was appointed general commanding the Western Department of the Army of the Confederate States of America. A long title. Responsible for maintaining the integrity of a line which stretched from Virginia to Kansas along the northern frontier of our new nation. That was a lot of line. But no one then, so far as I ever heard, doubted his ability to do whatever was required of him. This was largely because they did not know what forces he had to do it with. He had 20,000 poorly organized, poorly equipped troops to defend the area between the mountains of eastern Kentucky and the Mississippi River. By January, he had managed to double that number, disposing them this way. Polk on the left at Columbus opposing Grant, Hardee in the center at Bowling Green opposing Sherman, and Zollicoffer on the right at Cumberland Gap opposing Thomas. At each of these points, his commanders were outnumbered 2 and 3 to 1. Hoping to hold off the federal offensive so that he would have more time to build and shape his army, he announced that his situation was good, that he had plenty of troops, and that he had no fears about holding his ground. His statements were printed in all the papers, north and south. These were high times. Everyone still drunk on Manassas, and politicians talking about whipping the enemy with corn stalks. And the only disagreement among our people back home was whether one Southern volunteer was worth 10 Yankee hirelings or a dozen. 10 was the figure most frequently quoted, for people's minds ran mostly to round numbers in those days. The general must have known that reverses were coming, and he must have known, too, that when they came, the people would not understand. They came soon enough. First in mid-January at Fishing Creek, his right caved in. Zollicoffer himself was killed when he rode out front in a white rubber raincoat. He lay in a fence corner muddy and dead, while Union soldiers pulled hairs from his mustache for souvenirs. And his army was broken and scattered deep into Tennessee, demoralized. Early next month, Fort Henry fell to Grant's attack, and 10 days later, Fort Donelson. Bowling Green was evacuated then, outflanked, and Nashville was left to the enemy, the first real southern city to be lost. People were outraged. They had been expecting an advance, and now within a month everything had changed. Kentucky and Tennessee were being abandoned without a fight. They yelled for the general's scalp. But when the Tennessee representatives in Richmond went into the president's office to demand that he dismiss the Confederate commander in the West, Mr. Davis told them, "If Sidney Johnston is not a general, we had better give up the war, for we have no general," and bowed them out. That was a low ebb, but General Johnston took the blame just as he had taken the praise. He knew that the only way to regain public favor was to give the nation a victory, and he knew that the only way to halt the federal advance was to concentrate and strike. He chose Corinth, a railroad junction in North Mississippi, near the Tennessee River, as the place to group his armies. Grant, he believed, would try to break the Memphis and Charleston Railroad, which ran through Corinth, whenever Buell reinforced him. General Johnston planned to destroy Grant before Buell came up, after which he would attend to Buell. It was that simple. So Polk fell back from Columbus, leaving a strong garrison at Island Number 10, and Bragg came up from Pensacola and Ruggles from New Orleans, and Van Dorn was told to march from Arkansas and cross the river near Memphis. He was expected any day. Grant's army was encamped at Pittsburg Landing, on the near bank of the Tennessee River about 20 miles from Corinth. While General Johnston was concentrating, scouts and spies brought him full reports on Grant's strength and dispositions. He knew what he would find at Pittsburg, an army no larger than his own, with its back to the river, unfortified. The only digging they did was for straddle trenches, hemmed in by boggy creeks, disposed for comfort, and scattered the peacetime way. He went on with his plans. He would strike as soon as possible. By the end of March, we were almost ready. The Army of the Mississippi, Beauregard had named it, was divided into four corps: 10,000 under Polk, 16,000 under Bragg, 7,000 under Hardee, and 7,000 under Breckinridge. We were as strong as Grant and stronger than Buell. Everything was set, except for the delay of Van Dorn, who had run into some trouble getting transportation across the river. We waited. On the 2nd of April, Polk sent word that one of the enemy divisions was advancing from the river, heading for Memphis, maybe, we thought, though later we found this was not true. And that night, a cavalry scout reported that Buell's army was marching hard from Columbia to join Grant. Within 2 hours of the time the scout reached headquarters, General Johnston ordered the advance on Pittsburg Landing. Van Dorn or no Van Dorn, the march would begin Thursday, and we would strike Grant at daybreak Saturday, April 5th. I worked all Wednesday night with Colonel Jordan, Assistant Adjutant General on Beauregard's staff, preparing the march order. We used the opening section of Napoleon's Waterloo Order as a guide. There was always plenty of material about Napoleon whenever Beauregard pitched his tent. First, we sent out a warning note for all commanders to have their troops assembled for the march, with 3 days' cooked rations in their haversacks. Then the colonel hunched over the map with a sheaf of notes General Beauregard had written for him to follow. It wasn't much map, really. When I first looked at it, all I saw was a wriggle of lines and a welter of longhand notations, some of them even written upside down. But as the colonel went on dictating, it became simple enough. And after a while, it even became clear. I didn't know which I admired the most, Napoleon or Colonel Jordan. I was proud to be working with him. Two roads ran from Corinth up to Pittsburg. On the map, they resembled a strung bow, with the two armies at the top and bottom tips. The southern route through Monterey was the string. The northern route through Mickey's was the bow. Bragg and Breckinridge were to travel the string, Hardee and Polk the bow. Beyond Mickey's, within charging distance of the federal outposts, they were to form for battle in successive lines, Hardee across the front with one brigade from Bragg, who was to form the second line 500 yards in rear. Polk was to march half a mile behind Bragg, supporting him, and Breckinridge was to mass the reserve corps in Polk's rear. The flanks of the army, with the three lead corps extended individually across the entire front, rested on the two creeks which hemmed Grant in. As we advanced, each line would support the line in front, and the reserve corps would feed troops from the rear toward those points where resistance was stiffest. That way, The Federal army would be jammed into the northward loop of the creek on the left, or back against the Tennessee itself. It was the first battle order I had ever seen, and it certainly seemed complicated. But once you understood what it was saying, it was simple enough. I had had a share in composing it, watching it grow from notes and discussion into what it finally became. A simple list of instructions, which, if followed, would result in the annihilation of an army that had come with arrogance into our country to destroy us and deny our people their independence. But even though I'd watched it grow line by line, myself supplying the commas and semicolons which made it clearer, when it was complete, I could look at it as if it had been done without my help. And it was so good, so beautifully simple, it made me catch my breath. It did occur to me, even then, that all battle orders did this. They would all result in victory if they were followed. But this one seemed so simple, somehow so right, that I began to understand how Shakespeare must have felt when he finished Macbeth, even if I had only supplied the punctuation. Colonel Jordan was proud of it, too. I believe he really thought it was better than the one by Napoleon he had used as a model. Though, of course, he didn't say so. It worked so well on paper. The flat, clean paper. On paper, in the colonel's lamp-lit office, when we saw a problem was easy to fix. All we had to do was direct that corps commanders regulate their columns so as not to delay each other, halting until crossroads were cleared, keeping their files well closed, and so forth. It didn't work out that way on the ground, which was neither flat nor clean, nor, as it turned out, dry. The troops were green. Most of them had never been on a real tactical march before, and many of them received their arms for the first time when they assembled in their camps that Thursday morning. Frequently, during halts, I saw sergeants showing recruits how to load their muskets the regulation way. They were in high spirits, advancing on an enemy who for the past 3 months had been pushing us steadily backward over hundreds of miles of our own country. And they marched with a holiday air, carrying their muskets like hunters, so that the column bristled with gun barrels glinting at jaunty angles, like pins in a cushion. I stood with General Johnston beside the road and watched them go past, men of all ages and from all sections of the country, wearing homemade uniforms, many of them, and carrying every kind of firearm, from modern Springfields and Enfields back to smooth-bore flintlock muskets which were fired last in the War of 1812. When the 9th Texas swung past, we saw an elderly private who marched with the firm step of the old-time regular. He was singing, "I've shot at many a Mexican and many a Injun too, but I never thought I'd draw a bead on Yankee Doodle-Doo." The general turned to me with a smile. He, too, was marching against the flag he had served most of his life. During the period when he was being hailed as the savior of liberty, there were page-long biographies of him in all the newspapers, but they were as full of errors as they were of praise. I know because I had the true story from my father, who spent many a night beside a campfire with him down in Texas. Albert Sidney Johnston had just passed his 59th birthday at the time of the battle. He was born in Kentucky, the youngest son of a doctor. After 2 years at Transylvania University, he went to West Point. He was 19, older than most of the cadets and more serious. Leonidas Polk, the future Bishop General, was his roommate. Jefferson Davis, who also had followed him at Transylvania, was 2 classes below him. Johnston graduated high in his class and thus was privileged to choose his branch of service. He declined a position as aide to General Scott and chose the infantry. That was characteristic, as you'll see. Sometimes he behaved like a man in search of death. While he was a young lieutenant, stationed at Jefferson Barracks, he attended a ball in St. Louis where he met the girl he married a year later. She was from Louisville, and I've heard my father say she had the loveliest singing voice he ever heard. In the spring and summer of 1832, she stayed home with her parents while her husband went to fight in the Black Hawk War. When he returned, he found her dying. Physicians pronounced her lungs weak, bled her freely and often, and put her on a diet of goat's milk and Iceland moss. Johnston resigned from the army and came home to nurse her. That was 1833, the year the stars fell. In late summer of the second year, she died. After her death, he retired to a farm near St. Louis where they had intended to live when he left the army. But life was intolerable there, too filled with memories of the things they had planned together. It was at this time that he heard Stephen Austin speak in Louisville and threw in with the Texas Revolutionists. He joined as a private trooper, but soon he was appointed adjutant general. When he was made commander of the Texas Army and proceeded to his post, he found that Felix Houston, who was serving as acting commander, Old Leather Breeches he was called, felt that being superseded was an affront he couldn't abide with honor. Though he did not blame Johnston personally, he decided his only redress was to challenge him to a duel. He sent Johnston the following note: "I really esteem your character, and know that you must be sensible of the delicacy of my situation. I therefore propose a meeting between us, in as short a period as you can make convenient." Johnston replied, "After reciprocating the sentiments of respect and esteem, which you have been pleased to express toward me, it only remains to accord you the meeting proposed. I have designated 7 o'clock a.m. tomorrow," and signed it, "Your most obedient servant, A.S. Johnston." He had the choice of weapons by the code, but as there were no dueling pistols available, and as Houston had no experience with rapiers, with which Johnston himself was an expert, he agreed to use Houston's horse pistols. They were hair-trigger weapons. Houston had a reputation for being able to light matches with them at 50 feet. So Johnston watched Houston's trigger finger, and every time Houston was about to line up the sights, Johnston would fire without taking aim, causing Houston's figure to twitch and the shot to go astray. After 5 wild shots, Houston was boiling mad. It had passed beyond a mere question of honor now. His skill as a marksman was being ridiculed. Years later, my father, who was one of the seconds, said it would have been highly comical if it hadn't been deadly serious. Houston finally managed to steady himself, angry as he was, and put the 6th shot into Johnston's hip. After a slow and painful 5 weeks spent recovering from the wound, during which time Texas won her independence, Johnston served as Secretary of War in the cabinet. About this time he married a young cousin of his first wife, mainly, my father said, to have someone to mother his children. His share in the Mexican War was limited by politics, but he fought at the Battle of Monterey under Zachary Taylor, whom he much admired. My father was there, too, and told me afterwards that Johnston fought in the garb of a typical Texan, wearing a red flannel shirt and blue jean pants, a checkered coat and a wide-awake hat. But I was never able to imagine him dressed that way, no matter how hard I tried. After the war, he retired to China Grove Plantation in Brazoria County, enjoying life with his family, until in late 49 he was recalled into the U.S. Army by old General Taylor, who had been elected president. 6 years later, Jefferson Davis, Secretary of War under Franklin Pierce, gave him command of the newly organized 2nd Cavalry, and he spent the next 2 years fighting Indians on the frontier. Robert E. Lee was his lieutenant colonel, William Hardy and George Thomas as majors. In the late 50s, he led his troops against the Mormons out in Utah, and when he returned east in 1860, breveted brigadier, he was appointed to command on the Pacific coast, with headquarters at Fort Alcatraz near San Francisco. When Texas seceded, he crossed the desert with 30 pro-Southerners and became the rank and field general on the active Confederate list. After him came Lee, Joe Johnston, no kin, and Beauregard. That was his life, and it was a simple one. He knew disappointments, including the death of the one he loved most in the world, had a conspicuous share in a successful revolution, and knew the humdrum life of a country farmer. Then, at a time when he had every right to think he was through with war and the call of glory. He found himself at storm center of the greatest event of his country's history. At first there had been praise, then had come vilification. And now, standing beside the road and watching his troops start out on their march against the army that had pushed him back 300 miles, while the clamor of the South rang in his ears, accusing him of incompetence and even treason, there was satisfaction for himself and justification in the eyes of the people. The weather was clear, not a cloud in the sky when the march began. Regiment by regiment, the army lurched into column, rifles dressed at right shoulder shift, and the men stepping out smartly, lifting their knees as if on parade. Then the rain began. At first it didn't bother them, not even the abrupt, thunderous showers of Mississippi in April. But soon the wheels of the wagons and the artillery had churned the road into shin-deep mud, and after the first dozen laughs at men who slipped and sprawled, it began to wear thin. There were halts and unaccountable delays, times when they had to trot to keep up, and times, more frequent, when they stood endlessly in the rain, waiting for the man ahead to stumble into motion. The new muskets grew heavy. Haversack straps began to cut their shoulders, and there was less laughter and more cursing as the time wore past. Friday, when I approached the column from the rear, the road was littered with discarded equipment. Extra boots, sabers and bowie knives, overcoats, Bibles and playing cards. At one point, 4 miles out, there was a steel vest thrown into a fence corner, already flecked with rust, but gleaming like old silver in the rain. All that day, as I moved along the column, I came upon regiments halted beside the road, the troops leaning on their rifles while the commanding general's address was read to them by their colonels. General Johnston had written it Wednesday night in Corinth while we were composing the battle order. Soldiers of the Army of the Mississippi, I have put you in motion to offer battle to the invaders of your country. With the resolution and discipline and valor becoming men fighting, as you are, for all worth living or dying for, you can but march to a decisive victory over the agrarian mercenaries sent to subjugate you, and to despoil you of your liberties, your property, and your honor. Remember the precious stakes involved. Remember the dependence of your mothers, your wives, your sisters, and your children on the result. Remember the fair, broad, abounding land and the happy homes that would be desolated by your defeat. The eyes and hopes of 8 millions of people rest upon you. You are expected to show yourselves worthy of your lineage, worthy of the women of the South, whose noble devotion in this war has never been exceeded in any time. With such incentives to brave deeds, and with the trust that God is with us, your generals will lead you confidently to the combat, assured of success. A.S. Johnston, General Commanding. I heard it delivered in all styles, ranging from the oratorical, with flourishes, to the matter of fact, depending on the colonel. Many of them had been public men, and these made the most of the occasion, adding remarks of their own and pausing between sentences and phrases for the applause of their men, particularly after "Women of the South," which was good for a yell every time. But generally speaking, the result was the same. The troops cheered politely, lifting their hats, then fell back into ranks to continue the march. Bragg had almost as many men as the other three commanders put together. Marching all day Friday, he made just 6 miles, so he had to send word for Hardy to wait for him beyond the crossroads where their columns would converge. It must have galled him to have to send that message, for when I carried a dispatch to him that night at his roadside camp, he was hopping mad. He was not yet 50. A tall, gangling man made ferocious-looking by thick, bushy eyebrows, which grew in a continuous line across the bottom of his forehead. He was a West Pointer, a hero of the Mexican War, and his troops were acknowledged to be the best drilled in our army. They got that way because of the strictness of his discipline. I heard once that one of his soldiers attempted to assassinate him not long after the Mexican War.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?